The facts presented do not mean that Professor Ford was not sexually assaulted that night or at some other time, but they do lead me to conclude that the allegations fail to meet the more likely than not standard. Therefore, I do not believe that these charges can fairly prevent Judge Kavanaugh from serving on the court.
That was Senator Susan Collins of Maine. A few minutes ago, she said she will vote to confirm Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Everybody's been watching her. She was one of the key undecided Republicans. The other person everyone's been watching is Democrat Joe Manchin from West Virginia. Now he says he'll vote yes on Kavanaugh. Kavanaugh's ascension to the Supreme Court now is almost a sure thing. A final confirmation could come as soon as tomorrow. But no matter which side of this issue you're on, one thing is clear. From the nomination, to the testimonies, to the FBI investigation, to the Senate vote, across the USA, a lot of people are unhappy about the battle over Judge Kavanaugh's nomination. In fact, hundreds of anti-Kavanaugh protesters were arrested in Washington yesterday. Remember, we are just a few weeks away from the midterm elections, so the big question is, how will this rage play out politically? Paul Mitchell is vice president of Political Data, Inc. It's a bipartisan voter data firm. He's also a former Democratic political consultant. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how you doing?
So much is happening. So Kavanaugh's nomination has been a political fight from the beginning. Which party do you think has the most to gain now?
Well, it's actually, you have to think about it in which time frame, because in the very short term, I think it's clear that this is a win for Republicans. I think, you know, people like winning. And in the tribalism that we have in our political culture right now, I think aside from whatever concerns they might have, there's that sense of like we won or we got one over on the Democrats or Democrats were being obstructionist. And the Republican base, remember, has not been super motivated. And this could be the spark to help them, at least in the short term. The longer term, and there's a real question about when that longer term starts, could be that now Republicans have gotten their nominee, the excitement starts to wane. It's not about people don't turn out to show gratitude to a political party. They don't turn out to say thanks. They turn out because of hope or fears about things in the future. So it's possible that the peak of Republican excitement engagement is right now. And in the coming days, we'll have to see if that starts to wane as we get closer to Election Day.
So it may actually leave room for Democrats to gain some ground. Is that, do I understand you correctly?
Well, what I'm suggesting is that Democrats and Republicans both have been really kind of enraged over this issue. It has really sucked the oxygen out of so many other things. Democrats were already engaged and already expected to be pretty high turnout, especially for a gubernatorial election cycle, really unheard of high turnout. Now, in the short term, we expect that Republicans are engaged and excited, and they have their own, you know, kind of just tribal views right now. And as a result, that should, in the very short term, help them turn out and vote.
If we can look at California, wait, hold on 1 second. If we could look at this through the lens of gender, what about women voters? Do you think they are likely to not be so happy about this outcome right now?
Yeah, but it still falls within the tribalism. So Democratic women voters, I think, are enraged, and they were already likely to be turning out to vote because they were already enraged by, I could give you a laundry list of other things. And so the question is, did this Kavanaugh event spark Republicans who had kind of been slumbering through this election cycle, not been engaged, not been excited to turn out and vote? Did it awaken them right before the election? And in California, we start voting like this weekend.
Speaking of California, there are key House races here. There are seven districts currently held by Republicans where Hillary Clinton won in 2016. Democrats are hoping to flip those in November. You see the fight over Kavanaugh making a difference in those races?
Yeah, I do see it making a difference, and primarily making a difference in the motivation of Republicans to turn out. As of, you know, so far this election cycle, we've seen Republicans really kind of be lackluster. And in these competitive congressional races, we saw a relatively low turnout for Republicans and relatively high turnout for Democrats in these competitive congressional districts. If that were to carry through to November, I think that gives Democrats the best shot. Now that it seems as though the Republican base has been awoken and we're seeing polling suggesting that they're more energized, the question is will that recede by Election Day, or will that continue, that momentum continue through the election?
Wow. Now, we didn't think that there was any chance that Republican Duncan Hunter might end up being challenged in San Diego, but he's now under indictment. Could he actually lose that race?
That's one that's really interesting, because as soon as that indictment came out, and for listeners, it's not just an indictment. It is an indictment filled with corruption and even odd stories about him getting a first-class ticket for a bunny rabbit to fly across the country. So it is a salacious indictment, and it is definitely something that should impact the electability of anybody running for public office. However, in our tribalism and in an election cycle where Democrats and Republicans are voting as much for the future of what's going to happen in Washington, D.C., and questions of impeachment or questions of, you know, support or not support for Trump, in that environment, he might actually be able to withstand this indictment and be successful in an election cycle that's being defined by that tribalism. And when you look at what's happening in that district, you aren't seeing Democrats, meaning the National Democratic Congressional Committee or other groups, come in as heavily into that district. They're still continuing to spend more money in races further north into Orange County, like the 49th Congressional District, which is the Daryl Issa vacancy, or the 48th Congressional District, which is the Dana Rohrabacher seat.
So what about some of those other districts where Republicans are strong, but the Democrats are hoping to flip? If we can go through some of those races, which are the ones to watch?
Well, I definitely think the 49th is one to watch. That is a seat that Daryl Issa has held for a number of years, and he vacated the seat, so he's not running for re-election. So it's what we call an open seat, and really allows for, you know, the Democrats to go into a race where the incumbent Republican isn't on the ballot, so that power of incumbency kind of washes away. And in the primary, if you look at the sum total of all the Republican votes cast and the sum total of all the Democratic votes cast, there are actually more ballots cast for Democrats in that district than Republicans, which really was pretty shocking, especially for a primary in a gubernatorial election cycle when key Democratic constituencies, young people, renters, minorities, they don't turn out at the same rate. So that was pretty amazing and really put the 49th Congressional District probably at the top, maybe the top two or three national targets for Democrats, seats they believe they can flip. The 48th, which is another one that I mentioned, is also one of the top targets nationally, not just because it's a seat that Hillary won, but also because the incumbent congressman himself is so polarizing. What? Dana Rohrabacher, longtime congressman, in Orange County has...
Paul, we're running out of time, but thank you very, very much for your insight.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Happy to talk and to go over.
Okay. Paul Mitchell is Vice President of Political Data, Inc. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, which movie are you going to see this weekend? Here are film reviews. I'm Duarte Giraldino. Next on Players Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Duarte Giraldino, in for Madeline Brand. It's Friday, so you get to hear some movie reviews. Roth Cornett and Tim Grierson have some good advice for you about what to see over the weekend. Roth Cornett is editor-in-chief of Screen Junkies News. Tim Grierson is senior U.S. critic for Screen International. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
First, we start with Venom. The movie stars Tom Hardy and Michelle Williams both.
You will be this armless, legless, faceless thing, won't you? Rolling down the street like a turd in the wind.
What the hell are you?
We are Venom.
Roth, did he say turd?
He sure did. He said turd in the wind, which has now become sort of a famous internet meme representative of the film itself in some ways. This is a movie that almost appropriately is in the midst of an identity crisis. It's got a really fractured view of what it wants to be. And there are pieces of it that could be great, that could be a really fresh, innovative take on a comic book movie. Very funny. Ruben Fleischer, the director, also directed Zombieland, which was a riff on that genre. And when it's Tom Hardy as Eddie Brock versus Tom Hardy as Venom, it's magical. It really is hilarious and sort of taking the piss out of itself. And Venom's kind of that friend who's a jerk, but he's your jerk. That said, everything else that surrounds the movie does not work. And it takes about 50 minutes to get to Venom, which is disappointing for comic book fans and for me as a viewer who sits through those slog of a 15 minutes that are entirely self-serious and completely unaware, flat, lifeless. And really, I would say that Michelle Williams' wig in some ways represents the entire lack of care for detail.
Wow, you went in.
But this is the thing. I think it will become a movie that sort of people love because it's so bad it's good, in the way that they maybe love, like a friend of mine says, Mortal Kombat, or a movie like that. It is, in my mind, an objectively bad movie that audiences may end up enjoying anyway.
So, Tim, in the movie, it seems like the protagonist is a villain, but then he has a crazy change of heart. What's going on here?
Well, it's interesting because it's almost kind of like the way Deadpool was a different type of superhero movie, where he was much more sort of sarcastic and foul-mouthed, and that movie was R-rated and very kind of bloody. And in this movie, you know, Venom is, you know, legendarily a bad guy in the Spider-Man universe. And so what you have is sort of the origin story of a bad guy. And that's potentially kind of interesting. The problem is, Eddie Brock is a journalist. He's an investigative journalist. He goes around San Francisco and, like, discovers things that everybody in San Francisco kind of already should know by that point. But anyway, when he hooks up with this alien parasite that invades his body, it brings out sort of like this, like, kind of dark evil side that he's sort of wrestling with. That, again, is potentially interesting. The most fun in this movie is that Tom Hardy kind of plays a live-action Looney Tunes character. Like, he's kind of like Tasmanian Devil in certain ways. And there's, like, him and the CG character that he's sort of working with. But it's a movie that wants him to ultimately be the good guy. Riz Ahmed actually plays the real bad guy. He's like an Elon Musk sort of, you know, billionaire entrepreneur, you know, who's actually has, like, this evil thing in mind. I've never said this before about Riz Ahmed, and I hope I never say it again. He's terrible in this. Ooh, Riz Ahmed is one of our best actors, and he is actually awful. I would also point to this being another clear indication of why this movie does not work. It cannot figure out what to do with the great Riz Ahmed. You can see that they're attempting to try a different type of superhero movie. I think people will be affectionate towards it later. Because of the attempt, but you then have to actually sit through the movie to watch the movie, and it's not worth it.
Okay, if Ruben Fleischer had been able to fulfill, I think, the promise of those moments and gone all in and done a riff on the genre itself and the idea of a villain, where it basically comes the story of a boy and a symbiote. You know, he's his pet in some ways. And so I think that some people will embrace it now as a movie that's dumb popcorn fun, and it's going to do very, very well financially this weekend.
Well, that turd in the wind. Right, so let's change to a different one. Up next, The Hate U Give. This stars Amandla Stenberg, George Tillman Jr. He directs, and it's based on the YA book by Angie Thomas.
When I'm here, I'm Star version 2.
Yo, those kids are lit.
Basically, Williamson Star doesn't give anyone a reason to call her ghetto. And I hate myself for doing it. Until the weekend comes around.
I get those goosebumps every time.
What's up? Where you been at?
Man, I know you be hanging with all the white kids.
Shut up.
Yeah, when you're not around, we go that to the side.
out of the car.
Yo, Star, you okay?
Go back where he told you.
Khalil,
I'm not playing. Go back where...
What just happened here, Tim?
Well, that clip actually does a decent job of sort of encapsulating what this movie is about, which is, it's really good. It's a really good film. But Stenberg plays this teenager named Star. And Star lives with her family in a big city. But she is shipped to a private school, like a prep school, across town that's predominantly white. And so Star lives sort of two existences simultaneously. She talks about this in a voiceover that she does throughout the film, where at home and with her friends, she feels comfortable in her own blackness. But when she's at the prep school, she feels like she has to, in some ways, sort of be more white. And that sort of tension between her home life and her school life comes to a head when a good friend of hers is shot and killed by a white cop. Mm. And so she has to, because she was the only witness, she has to testify at a grand jury to determine if that cop should stand trial. It's a really smart, thoughtful look at racism, which is really impressive. We've had a lot of, I think, really good films about racism this year. But this film is out through a studio. This is out through Fox. And this movie, for a studio movie, for a, not a big budget movie, but nonetheless something that comes out through Fox, is actually pretty upfront about racism in America and talks about it. And also, I think very much to George Tillman's credit, the director of the film, he does not paint a very simplistic portrait of what race is like in America, especially talking about the idea that a movie itself cannot solve these problems. It's actually kind of ambivalent in certain ways. There's a lot of nuance in the film. And the young actress, Amanda Liss Stenberg, is really, really terrific. She's done some other things before this, but this really feels like a real breakout role for her. She really kind of carries the burden of the movie on her shoulders. And you feel what this character is kind of going through in her life and the pressures that she's facing. Her mother is played by Regina Hall. She is terrific. Her father is played by Russell Hornsby. He's also really, really good. This movie is opening somewhat limited this weekend. It opens wider October 19th. I highly recommend it.
Interesting to see. Now, last we have A Star is Born. It's a remake of the 1976 movie, which was a remake of the 1937 movie of the same name. Now, this is Bradley Cooper's directorial debut, and he stars opposite Lady Gaga.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Okay.
Tell me something, girl.
Do you write songs or anything?
I don't sing my own songs.
Why?
I just don't feel comfortable.
Why wouldn't you feel comfortable?
Almost every single person has told me they like the way I sounded, but that they didn't like the way I look.
I think you're beautiful.
Roth. Many of us didn't see the original 1976 Barbara Streisand and Chris Christopherson movie. What's this story about?
Sure. I am one who has seen all of the versions of A Star is Born. The 1937 Janet Gaynor and Frederick March movie is the movie I say sort of made me fall in love with movies when I was 8 years old, very late one night.
Was it that good?
It was that good. And I actually, unpopular opinion, that one's still my favorite. That said, this is now my second favorite. This is a movie that is a classic Hollywood movie in that it's about the things that we associate with Hollywood fame. The sort of addiction to celebrity, addiction in general, to chemicals, to emotional addiction, this desire that we all have to be seen and felt. And how rare those moments are. And so that when they do happen, we chase that dragon, whether it's in a relationship or whether it's because we're famous. But you also maybe it can consume you and overwhelm you. And then you are taken by other addictions. In this movie, in this case, Bradley Cooper's character is an alcoholic as well. And it's about finding authenticity within that in a relationship. And so it's sort of got everything, which is why I think, and it's a tragic romance, you know, it'll just make you ugly cry. I think that's why people love A Star is Born and we keep returning to it. And I've got to say, I am so impressed with Bradley Cooper in this movie because he is essentially conducting and first chair. And he gives one of the best performances of his career. But he is smart enough as a director to get out of Gaga's way and allow her to just strip her down so that her pure talent is raw. It's undeniable. It is seductive. We fall in love with her, and we must, because in order for this movie to work in the same way that rom-coms work, we have to actually fall in love with the female character. She's actually more important in that way. But Bradley Cooper is phenomenal in the film as well. Matthew Libatique's cinematographer. He also shot Venom, shockingly. He's a genius, and I think his cinematography represents what the movie is. It's naturalistic. It's incredibly relatable. Gaga is relatable, and yet it's lyrical and larger than life and tragic. This is, I think, a contender for all of the awards.
Do you really?
I really do. And I think it's a long season, and there are people that would caution me to not get ahead of myself. There is always the possibility that this is a genre film. It's a romance. They tend to get dismissed. But I really think it deserves the credit that it's getting, and that it will have strong legs. People will see this movie multiple times. I will.
Tim, what's your take? It's been called nearly perfect.
I don't think it's nearly perfect, but I will say, if you haven't seen any of the other versions of A Star is Born, don't worry, because I think one of the things that works for the film, but is also a thing that I always kept in mind while watching, is that in some ways, we have seen this story in lots of different ways. It is about, just like Roth said, it's about people falling in love in the entertainment business, following their aspirations, following their sort of like their creative ambitions. It's not, it's funny, in terms of Oscars and stuff like that, it's not entirely dissimilar from La La Land in certain ways, because it is about, and from Roth's reaction, depends on how one feels about La La Land. But I think both of them speak to the same kinds of things, which is people falling in love and having to decide between career and relationships and how those things are sometimes in conflict with one another. I think what also is interesting about the movie is that, again, when you've seen the earlier versions, there are certain things in this movie that are very cliched. But what I think is strong about the film is it talks about the fact that the reason why cliches exist is because there is truth to them. I think one of the things I do like about A Star is Born, even though there is a certain amount of familiarity, you know where the story is going. You can feel in certain ways just from seeing other movies where the story is going. But regardless, I think what's really interesting is this idea of, we all know that there are certain ways that things are probably going to play out in life, especially when people fall in love, that there's going to be problems. People have high highs and then low lows. This is the way things work. But we as individuals think that we are somehow going to be able to overcome the inevitability of certain things. What's tragic about the movie in certain ways is Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga are part of a continuum of this type of thing, of people falling in love. They're like another version of A Star is Born, essentially. They think that somehow they can do things differently so that it won't end up the way that happens for other people in the same type of situation. So the familiarity hurts maybe in certain ways for the movie, but the thing that's actually kind of really poignant about that at the same time.
Well, I'm excited to see it. Thank you so much both for letting us know what we should be watching this weekend. Tim Grierson is senior U.S. critic for Screen International, and Roth Cornett is editor-in-chief of Screen Junkies News. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, hip-hop is like the soundtrack for graffiti art. That's why a new exhibit combines them with classic pictures of hip-hop artists. Some of today's great graffiti artists paint on those pictures. The result is some remarkable visual art.
They're really beautiful, and you can see all the detail, and the colors are so vivid and bright.
I'm Duarte Geraldino. You can follow me on Twitter at Duarte Geraldino. The mashup is next on Press Play. This is Press Play, and I'm Duarte Geraldino, in for Madeline Brand. When you think about old-school hip-hop, images of graffiti come to mind, right? Our next two guests are using the two art forms to create a whole new experience. Jeanette Beckman is a photographer. In the 1970s, she was living in London. Turns out, that was the perfect place to take pictures of young up-and-coming punk bands like The Clash and The Sex Pistols. But in the early 1980s, she moves to New York at the dawn of hip-hop, and she starts taking pictures of bands like Run DMC, The Beastie Boys, and LL Cool J. Say Adams, on the other hand, started out as a graffiti artist. His work was showing alongside people like Jean-Michel Basquiat and Keith Haring. He later became creative director at Def Jam Records, where LL Cool J and the Beastie Boys got their start. Now Beckman and Adams have teamed up on a book and an exhibit. It's called The Mashup. It starts with Jeanette Beckman's iconic photographs of 80s hip-hop acts, and then Say Adams brings in a bunch of graffiti artists to add a whole new layer to the shots. They're actually painting right on top of those photos. The exhibition opens next Thursday at the Fahey Klein Gallery on North La Brea. Jeanette, Say, welcome to Press Play.
Hi.
Hey, thank you for having us.
So the idea of these artists actually painting on top of these iconic photographs, at first it thinks, oh my God, are you desecrating these photos? But then I look at the photos and they're amazing, this new experience. How did you get the idea for this?
Well, I naturally, like a lot of folks, love Jeanette's classic imagery, whether it was the punk images or rock and roll or hip-hop. And so I just thought, these images are so beautiful. How can we create something that can connect with a new, younger audience that sadly, in some cases, may not be familiar with a lot of these subjects? But since the 80s are back in a big way, I thought, what if I had my graffiti and street art friends paint on top of Jeanette's photographs? And that was really the idea. I just, you know, made a call to some of my buddies, and most of them are cultural pioneers who've been around a very long time. These are the people that started the graffiti movement back in the 70s. And they were all excited to work over these images because, like anybody of a certain age, this is also part of their childhood. So they remember all of these moments.
I remember when it was coming up. You know, I grew up in the Bronx. Hip-hop was there. I thought it was incredibly local back then. And then it took over the world, Jeanette, and you were there documenting it.
So amazing. I know. Well, the first hip-hop show I ever saw actually was in London in 1982, and it was the very first hip-hop show to come to Europe. I was working for a music paper, and I went down to the hotel just to kind of cover the guys, meet them. And they were just, the energy was so amazing. I just started photographing everybody and I didn't even know who they were. And that day I got pictures of Afrika Bambaataa, Futura, Dondi, Ramelzy, the Rocksteady crew, Fab Five Freddy. And I had no idea who they were, but I was just kind of fascinated for some reason. Then I went to the concert at night and that completely blew my mind.
Well, the hip-hop world is a fantasy. Group into the rhythms of reality. Just the grab of the mic and taking control. Being the monumental master, playing the role. Pulling the curtains back and letting you know that when I'm on the mic, you must have run the show.
So you have that knack, Jeanette, because you were really, you know, taking pictures of those punk bands that would become sort of iconic in and of themselves. Now we know, obviously, all these hip-hop greats are amazing, they're geniuses in their field, but back then, we didn't know any of that. What was it that you saw that made you say, hey, I need to take this photo?
You know, I think I've just always been attracted to this kind of rebel culture thing of people rebelling against, you know, what was punk, you know, was rebelling against the English class system and all of that. And then I came here and hip-hop seemed to be the same thing. You know, people who didn't have a voice before were voicing, you know, talking about their lives and it, you know, making, and they didn't have money and they were making their own clothes and just doing what they wanted to do. And I've always been attracted to that, this kind of street style, rebel culture stuff.
So did hip-hop bring you to New York? I know you see your first one in London. Did right. You say, oh, I got to go to the home to where this is happening?
Well, strangely, I was just coming to visit a friend that Christmas. And, you know, I got off the train on West 4th Street. And, you know, there's some kid with a boombox and, you know, somebody breakdancing on a piece of cardboard. And I was like, oh, this is really good. I like this. The trains are covered in graffiti. I just stayed. It was kind of random, honestly.
So, Jeanette, the work that you did by documenting these greats, they sort of stand by themselves as perfect in and of themselves.
Thank you.
But in this collaboration, say, you bring artists and you tell them, okay, now spray paint on these great photographs. Did they look at you like, what?
Well, the thing is, you have to remember that the people that I'm selecting also superstars. And that's the thing that's so great about this collection of mashup pieces, is that it combines Jeanette's beautiful photography with these iconic graffiti artists. And then you take into consideration my history as a creative director, and it's like the Justice League.
My radio, believe me, I like it loud. I'm the man with the box that can rock the crowd. Walking down the street to the hardcore beat while my JVC vibrates the concrete. I'm sorry if you can't understand, but I need a radio inside my hand. Don't mean to offend other citizens, but I kick my fire way past 10.
There's this image of LL Cool J in the book. Describe that.
Well...
What was it like when you took it? So what's the original like, Jeanette?
That was the first ever press photo for LL Cool J. And, you know, I didn't know who he was. He'd just been signed to Def Jam. And I think you probably know, so he was probably like 16 or 17 years old. And, you know, he was just a young kid. He just walked into my studio. I had a studio in what's now Tribeca. He had a big radio, of course, and I had lights set up. And he just stood on my spot that I'd marked out and put the radio on his shoulder. And I was like, this is it. This is the picture. And I took the picture. You know, and he's wearing a Kangol hat. It's really iconic, actually. I love that picture. He's so young.
You then have a graffiti artist work magic and create something totally new. It's almost as if, say, there is this conversation between the present and the past, because the artist is literally responding
to the history. And in this particular case, it's Jules Muck, who happens to be a woman. And so she's responding to maybe something that she's always felt about LL. And this really interesting image that she painted with Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh crew. And, you know, Eeyore is always in search of love. And LL had a song called I Need Love.
Inside my soul, because my soul is cold. One half of me deserves to be this way till I'm old. But the other half needs affection and joy. And the warmth that is created by a girl and a boy. I need love.
I mean, they really have reinterpreted my photos. And I was amazed that, A, they wanted to do it. You know, and they were just working on 11 by 14 prints. Everybody got an 11 by 14 print.
That's small.
That's small. And for people who are used to painting walls.
And the beautiful thing about this exhibition is that these pieces are blown up to 30 by 40.
They're 40 by 60.
Massive, even larger. Yeah. And they're really beautiful. And you can see all the detail. And the colors are so vivid and bright.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about hip hop and graffiti art. And a new exhibit, photographer Jeanette Beckman and artist Say Adams are working together on a book and exhibition called The Mashup. You know, one of the pictures in the book is of the hip-hop duo Eric Bien and Rakim. They've got the big chains on and the bling, and they're posed up against the bare brick wall with that really tough look on their faces. What were these young hip-hop acts like to work with, Jeanette, back then?
Well, it was interesting because I'm British. And I think people were really nice to me because of that. You know, they were sort of interested in me, and I never got, you know, any attitude from anybody. And these guys just came around my studio, and I wanted to take a picture of them outside. I think I was shooting this actually for a British magazine. And so we just walked around the corner to the parking lot and found a wall and took the picture. And you're right, they had like, you know, Rakim, he has that amazing hip-hop attitude.
In the door, I said it before, I never let the mic magnetize me no more, but it's biting me, fighting me, inviting me to rhyme. I can't hold it back, I'm looking for the line, taking off my coat, clearing my throat, the rhyme will be kicking in till I hit my last note. My mind remains to find all kind of ideas, self-esteem makes it seem like a thought took years to build, but still say a rhyme after the next one. Prepared, never scared, I'll just bless one, and you know that I'm the soloist, so Eric B, make him clap to this. Make a clap to this.
What is the artist, the graffiti artist, trying to convey?
The artist that created this piece of Eric B. and Rakim, his name is Part One, P-A-R-T. And Part is one of the original style masters of graffiti. So in the early 70s, this guy was already out there making a name for himself as a youngster, painting these beautiful trains. And parts are a lot older now, but he is definitely considered one of the fathers, or I should say, you know, grandfathers of graffiti style. And he's still out there making work today at a really high level.
How did he transform this image?
Well, what was really interesting about this particular piece is that his idea was, I am going to create this beautiful masterpiece and all these vivid, bright colors on this wall as though Jeanette showed up and used the wall as a backdrop with his piece already in place.
Make a clap to this. A lot of this project connects the world of hip hop with graffiti, and sometimes people don't necessarily recognize that connection.
Right.
But when you hear hip hop, you almost automatically think graffiti.
Yeah, yeah. I worked with a lot of these artists. I designed album covers for them. I created logo designs and ad campaigns for them. So to be able to put together a collection that sort of celebrates the graffiti aspect of it is really great.
Is there something that one photograph, one new creation, because obviously you took all the photographs, Jeanette, but now they've been transformed by these graffiti artists. Is there one in particular that speaks to you?
Well, this particular picture done by Queen Andrea of Run DMC, I mean, that's one of my iconic pictures, and I photographed them in 1984, and she just made this incredible, beautiful, bright, colorful image.
What about you, Sid? Is there one in particular or two
for
that...
For me, I think one of my favorites is the piece that my friend Sess did of Big Daddy Kane. He did an image of Big Daddy Roth, one of his characters, creating, like, giving Big Daddy Kane a haircut, like a buzz cut. And it's just so much fun to look at the way people interpret ideas and just to have the freedom to just do whatever they wanted to do. I'm different, so don't compare me to another, because they can't hang word to the mother, at least not with the principal in this pedigree. So when I roll on your rappers, you better be ready to die because you're petty. You're just a butter knife, I'm a machete.
Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
That's photographer Jeanette Beckman and artist Say Adams. The book is The Mashup, and you can see the pictures in person starting next Thursday. That's when the show opens at the Fahey Klein Gallery on North La Brea. Sign it and take a walk as the Canes start to talk, cause ain't you don't have seven. I'm the big daddy. Ain't you don't have seven. I'm the big daddy. Next, they are Instagram-worthy experiences, but are pop-up museums worth it? Would you like to sit on a pizza box throne or walk through an exhibit about candy? Hear one reporter's take up next. This is Press Play, and I'm Duarte Geraldino in for Madeline Brand. Did you see the two new pop-up experience museums that opened in the LA area this week? There's Cheat Day Land, where you can lift donut dumbbells, swim in a cereal bowl, and pose in front of murals of chocolate cake. Or you can head over to the Pizza Experience in Pasadena. Pop into the pizza nightclub, sit on a pizza box throne. Yes, it's a real thing. And if none of these museums excite you, you still won't escape the pics, because your Instagram feed is going to be flooded with photos from your friends who did go. New York Times critic Amanda Hess spent the whole summer visiting these pop-up museums. She says the experience nearly broke her. Amanda Hess is here with us now. Hey, Amanda.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So they nearly broke you? What did you mean by that?
Well, I'm here to tell of the experience, so I survived. But, you know, for things that are marketed as super fun, I found them to be both incredibly boring and almost, like, existentially painful
Ooh.
To go through all of them. I was not a fan.
Okay, so what was an experience that you thought was particularly existentially painful?
So I went to a bunch of them in New York. I went to one called Candytopia, that's like a candy wonderland. I went to one called The Color Factory, which is themed around colors. I went to one called The Rosé Mansion, which is pink wine themed. And that was the last one I went to. And it was really hard because even though wine is something that is really interesting and actually important to a lot of people, and there's a lot of history there and there's science there, it was just so incredibly janky and superficial to the point where they couldn't even figure out enough stuff to fill like the entire experience with wine-related things. So there was just like rooms that were filled with plastic flamingos because flamingos are pink and rosé is also pink. There was a room that had two bathtubs that kind of looked like an erectile dysfunction commercial that were filled with fake rose petals because rose sounds like rosé. There was even a station where you fill out this little survey about your favorite elements of wine, and then someone who is standing behind a counter in a lab coat just like pumps from different bottles of wine into the same cup, and then you drink that.
So you actually got a glass of wine, right? Please tell me that you got
it. You get total the equivalent of two glasses of wine for $50.
Ooh, $50. You could have bought like five bottles.
Very expensive glasses of wine, yes. But I did appreciate that, you know, you did get something to sort of like help you along the experience. That's not true in all of these Instagram places. Many of them, you know, all you have is yourself and your cell phone.
Oh my gosh, this sounds like purgatory. You know, we had Candytopia here in LA in Santa Monica. You didn't like that one either?
No, although I went in the morning. I went around 10:30, and so there were a lot of families there when I went, and the kids seemed to like it. So, I mean, I'm not such a hardened person that I can't appreciate, like, the smiles and laughter of children.
Are you sure?
So that helped.
So where did this pop-up museum trend start?
I think it started with the Museum of Ice Cream, which started a couple of years ago, and just actually is the first one to institute a permanent location in San Francisco, so no longer a pop-up. But I think it also comes from, there's like a variety of other trends in the culture that I think have been culminating toward this. So experiential theater like Sleep No More or escape rooms where you are locked in a room and you have to figure out how to get out of it. This to me is just the height of superficiality in these experiential trends where the point is really not so much to be there as it is to leave and post photos on social media.
Oh my God, the point is not as much to be there, but to leave. Why do we even call them museums then? It seems like a stretch to use that word.
Yeah, I actually think there are people in the museum community who are a little annoyed by this trend, partly because A, these places are more expensive than some of the greatest museums in the world. In New York, you know, the Met or the MoMA are less expensive than going to Candytopia. And yet somehow, you know, because they are created as marketing vehicles for themselves, they are bringing a lot of people into them. I think the reason that they call themselves museums is just because there's no real word for what they are that sounds upstanding, I guess. So a lot of them call themselves museums. Some of them call themselves experiences. One of the things that really gnawed at my soul about that is the idea that you have to state that something's an experience, because usually when human beings have experiences, we don't have to like call them that in their titles. So the idea that these places have to sort of announce themselves as that is a little suspicious to me.
So what do these pop-ups say about the way we think and interact with traditional art? And I know it's a subjective term, but I'm talking about the kind of art that you find in permanent museums.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like when I interact with a piece of art, something that was created by an artist to have some sort of meaning, it's a very rich experience because the piece is asking me to consider it and to build my own meaning and to interact with its meaning and even to maybe add some meaning to my life. In the cases of these fake museums, I actually felt that even though they pretend to be so much about me, so much about the person who's there, and to really honor them in the center of the experience, that they have a really low view of the people who are there because they don't ask them to think about anything. They don't expect that they add any meaning to their lives. They just see them as an image.
Wow, we need to get you a piece of candy. Thank you so much for chatting
with
us.
Thank you for having me.
Amanda Hess is a critic at large for the New York Times. And now it's time for feedback with Christian Bordal. So Christian, what is on social media about our show?
Well, a little bit on the pop-up museums. Matt Sylvester agrees with Amanda. He says, in my experience, these pop-up experiences feel like shallow props for people to take 100 different versions of the same picture. But Sidra says, I know what they are and I enjoy them anyway.
See, there's value to them.
That's right. Of course, the big story today happened just before we went live. That was Susan Collins, one of the last Republican holdouts. She went on the floor of the Senate. In a long, detailed speech, she announced that she will be voting to confirm Judge Brett Kavanaugh, which pretty much seals it for Kavanaugh, barring anything, you know, weird and wonderful happening. The Senate's going to vote to confirm him tomorrow as the newest justice of the Supreme Court. Not a lot of happy people out there in our listenership. Michelle Seekin says she is reiterating all the things men say to make excuses for their bad behavior. She's part of the problem. Erin Cassidy says, we're well beyond Roe now, Senator. You're not going to make anyone besides the president and his minions happy by voting yes for this person. Elaine Zubko says, she is a major disappointment and disgrace. I hope the voters of Maine see the light and vote her out. Victoria Minette says, I can't listen to her lame excuses. This isn't the first time she's dangled a no vote in our faces and then voted yes in the end. Robert Kessler says, this is how our society dies. Not in battle, but in deafening silence as a result of apathy and blind loyalty to party lines. Well, I don't know if there's a deafening silence right now. Seems like there's a lot of people talking about this. Piper Riley says she sold out all the women and sexual abuse survivors in this country. But Rocky Fresh says, hey, facts matter and fairness matters. Jay Winding says, term limits, please. So there's a lot of people who are not so happy about Senator Susan Collins deciding that she is going to support Brett Kavanaugh's nomination.
It was a major historic moment. Thank you so much, Christian.
Absolutely.
And that's Press Play for today. Our producers this week are Sarah Sweeney, Christian Bordal, Amy Ta, Michelle Eloy, Yael Ivanor, and Alexandria Sivtrigvadotur. Mario Saavedra is our technical director. We got engineering help from Phil Richards. And I'm Duarte Geraldino. It's been such a pleasure to be with you this week. Madeline Brand is back next week. This is Press Play.